The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Joining me as my special guest today is Martin Armstrong. He heads up Armstrong Economics. And Martin, I want to begin with a topic that last time you were on the program, gold was rising, and you're saying that, you know, we could experience a critical correction here. And since that time, we've seen the price of gold come down from the $1,900 range on the day you and I are speaking. It's around $1,660 or close to it. So let's talk about that. And a point that you're making that we are in a huge bull market when it comes to volatility.
Yes, that's basically it. I think also what a lot of people have to understand is that we have a major sovereign debt crisis. However, it's not where everybody goes down the drain all at one time. It began, you know, with Greece, and then they begin looking around and they see Portugal, Spain, and Italy, and so on. But eventually this will move over and will hit Japan. It will probably hit the United States, but we're not really looking for that until most likely around 2016 is when it will begin. And to fundamentally put it in perspective, currently we're spending about $4 billion a week in interest. By 2016, that will be about 10, and by about 2020, it should be at 15. And that's assuming interest rates don't go up, and that's, you know, not realistic. But so that's the very best possible scenario.
Martin, when you consider the fact that we're adding, what is it? Currently, we're adding about $100 billion of debt every month. I mean, how long is it before we hit a brick wall? You're saying 2016, but is it a possibility it can hit before then?
Most likely not. And the reason I'm saying that is that Americans tend to focus on America, but actually we are the best of everybody around because we also have the strongest and largest economy. Europe is much more in trouble than people realize. You know, the big banks are still largely involved with the government. The government owns still a lot of a proportion of them. But the sovereign debt crisis there is much more serious in respect to put it in U.S. terms, it would be as if the banks were obligated to hold all the various 50 states' debt equally. You know, that's the problem with Europe. There is no single federal debt. So the sovereign debt crisis in Europe affects the banks directly, and that's why the U.S. was cutting rates, and China and Canada, all trying to help bail out Europe. But the United States will go, but I'm telling you, we're the best of the lot. Japan and its debt to GDP is about almost twice as bad as we are. So I think we're largely the last one to go rather than the first. And Europe, the structure is very unsound, where we don't have that problem here. But if the banks were using all the various different state debts as reserves, we would see everything crumble very rapidly here as well. So I think we have a little bit of time left before it hits the United States.
Martin, it almost reminds me of what you're describing as a game of musical chairs. One by one, the chairs are kicked out and there's fewer left. So it's Europe now, maybe a couple of years, it's Japan, and then eventually circles down here. In your latest piece, you take a quote from something our president said, "I refuse to leave our children with debt they cannot pay." As I look at these numbers, at the rate of which we're growing, I don't believe we can pay them off now. nor are we likely to pay them off in the future. What's your take on that?
There's no game plan to ever pay anything off. And that's not just the United States, but that's all the governments. Since World War II, you know, we began with this whole process of debt under the theory that if you borrow, it's less inflationary than if you print. And that made sense when the debt was small, and two, you couldn't borrow against it. So those that are old enough will remember, you know, savings bonds, you know, e-bonds, etc. You could not take those down to a bank and borrow against them. You had to cash them in, but bank could not use them as collateral. What has happened today is that we have a vast amount of debt, and 40% of the interest is being paid out overseas, and it is now the reserves. So we're borrowing against it. It is actually, it would be cheaper if we printed money, because effectively, if we had just printed what we needed, the debt would be about 40 cents on the dollar. The interest expenditure is, it is as if we're printing dollars that are paying interest. So we're doubling things dramatically, and that's the real problem.
Now, you talk about this crisis that we're heading into, which is going to be a sovereign debt crisis. It is so drastic that it will bring down all government and require a complete restructuring, and you believe we have passed the point of no return.
I mean, I regularly go down to Washington, and I kind of work with the, I would say, the good guys that know what's happening, but there is no consensus down there to get anything done. The best way I can explain it, let's say you're standing at the bottom of the hill in San Francisco, and a guy comes up to you and sticks out his hand and says, "I just saved your life. I think I'm entitled to a tip." And you look at him and you say, "Yeah, what'd you do?" He says, "Well, there's a car at the top of the hill. It started to roll. I jumped in it and I put on a brake. So I saved your life." Now, are you going to look at the guy as, you know, a scam artist, or are you going to believe him? That's the problem politicians have. They will not run and say, "Well, vote for me because I saved your job." You're going to say, "How do I know you did?" So consequently, what happens is that they really do nothing. They wait for the crisis to happen. Then they have investigations. Then they want to lock somebody up and say, "Oh, okay, fine, it'll never happen again." But they take no preemptive measures whatsoever. So TARP got passed in 2 days. If you went and you proposed TARP a year in advance, it would never pass. It's crisis management. And that's the way Washington operates. That's the way Europe operates. Unfortunately, I think it's a problem of our democratic type system in that we don't have term limits. So, I mean, right now I can tell you in Washington, there is absolutely nothing that's going to take place because you've got a presidential election ahead. So they won't do anything. Nobody's going to take a risk. If you went and said, "Listen, if you pass this bill, if you don't pass it, 25,000 people are going to die tomorrow," they go, "Well, you know, I'm not sure. Maybe that might not happen." If they die, then they go, "Oh, well, now we're going to go find the guy that did it." And they're great at that. Grandstanding, you know, putting on a good show that they're calling in everybody. But do they actually charge anybody? No, of course not. So it's all just really like a TV show. That's pretty much what it is. And when you testify, I can tell you I've testified before Congress. You present them with the questions that you're going to be asked. You give them a scenario and a listing of what everything is in advance. And if you're looking at these guys like Blankfein or somebody else who's going to testify supposedly in an antagonistic manner, their lawyers meet in advance to say what they'll answer and what they won't. It's all a show. These things are not really ad hoc, but that's the world we live in. They want to make it look good, and so, you know, vote for me because I did X, Y, Z.
Let's talk about something that looks pretty good and has taken a lot of market participants by surprise, and that's the rise in the U.S. stock market. And you talk about this is really clearly not well understood. What is taking place here, especially with the recent rise in interest rates from a very, very low level, capital is starting to shift from bonds to stocks, and it's at this early stage. And that's why it's remaining confusing to a lot of people, because you'll see people, the stock market will go up and they'll say, well, you know, we're coming close to correction. It's overbought, et cetera, et cetera. But it's almost like disbelief that these numbers continue to go up.
Well, I mean, that's basically what we warned would happen in at our conference in December 3rd and 4th. And we put out a large special report on this thing and said, listen, cash is at record highs. Institutional cash, fund cash, individual cash. There's so much cash sitting on the sidelines. Everybody's been waiting for the crash, for it to go down. It's not going down. What we're at is basically at the threshold of a major breakout more towards the upside. And what will happen is all this cash that's sitting there, it's going to be continue to chase the market. Once the market starts making new highs, they're going to say, oh my God, I should have got in. But you have to understand is that bull markets take rise with higher interest rates. They decline with lower interest rates. You know, whoever started this nonsense, I don't know. I mean, look at interest rates in Japan. They went basically to zero, and the market's gone down for 26 years. It didn't go up. Interest rates, when they begin to rise, it is a showing of there is a demand for money. When the economy is going well and everybody's out there borrowing and building and doing all sorts of things, interest rates go up. And every economic decline, the interest rates decline. And what you're looking at right now is the government has still been really bailing out the banks. Yes, they've lowered interest rates dramatically. But the problem is you go to the bank and they'll offer you, you know, 0.7% to lock up your money for 3 years. And yet you go to them and you say, well, I'd like a car loan. Fully secured. They won't do unsecured loans anymore. Fully secured. And what do they want? They want 4 or 5%. So what I have never seen the spread between what they're paying and what they're charging so high. And to put it in proportion, if this was 1980, when interest rates were 17%, they would be charging 9,700%. To be paying people 0.7 and charging 4%, this is the biggest spread in history. So what's happened is yes, the Fed has lowered interest rates and everybody says, oh, that should be inflationary, blah, blah, blah. But it has not taken place. The reason is because that has not been passed on to the banks, by the banks. They're just pocketing all the profits. So they are really still bailing out the banks, just covertly. And, I mean, if the banks had lowered the interest rates and said, okay, fine, you can get a car loan now at 0.9%, that would be one thing, but that's not happening. So the interest rates that they're charging the consumer have not really come down that much, and yet the interest rates they're paying the consumer have gone to absolutely rock bottom. So at this stage in the game, there's so much cash sitting out there, and it is not earning anything. You're better off looking now at stocks that will put in, you know, you have a lot of good stocks that, one, are actually trading below book value because people have been so bearish. And two, if you look at some of the stocks with dividends that they're paying, you know, you can earn 4 to 7%. So that is what is starting to attract the capital. And this is the way it always begins. It began this way in 1925 as well. And so eventually, you know, you start looking at it and you say 0.7 or I can earn 5%. I'll take the 5%. Thank you very much. If the market comes down 5%, you're even.
Yeah, I'm just looking at Bloomberg screen on Treasuries, Martin, and I never thought I'd see this. A 3-month Treasury bill, less than 0.1%, a 1-year Treasury, less than 0.2%. You're right. If I'm a bank and I'm paying a depositor 7 basis points to tie up their money for a couple of years and then turn around and charge 3.5-4%, I'm making a fortune.
Percentage-wise, it's unbelievable. I mean, there isn't a business that I know of that earns that kind of a percentage return on capital.
And maybe this is why, Martin, I think that you're starting to see the bank stocks move. The financials are moving, one of the best performers this year.
It's the amount of money that they are making on their returns at historic highs. Some of the resource stocks in Australia are trading, you know, below book value. I mean, I think the metals are still under pressure because people are going to really be looking at the stock market and things like that largely probably going into for the next year and a half or so. You know, the metals, you have a lot of people, you know, keep talking about the, you know, the debt crisis and everything's going to fall apart. It's true, but I think they're a little premature. I don't think gold's going to go down dramatically, but I don't see it really taking off until probably after about 2015. It's then you're looking at going between there into about 2017. 17 might be around the high where we start getting back into this debt crisis issue. Now, what will happen with the debt crisis, just as you just looked at what the interest rates on the treasuries, how can there be a debt crisis when there's so much cash just sitting there? The debt crisis comes when the government goes to sell the bonds and the people don't want to buy them. That's when the debt crisis begins to really unfold. All right, so you saw that in some of the Greek stuff. It was even last October, Germany couldn't sell all its bonds. U.S. hasn't had that yet. And when that begins to happen, then you're going to see the interest rates begin to rise. And as that begins to rise, you'll then set the deficit in an exponential move. But right now, what you have is you have governments, Europe and the United States, becoming very, very aggressive on taxation. They're going after everybody, everything they can possibly get. So they're really putting the brakes on the economy, per se. So what you really want to look at right now is that there'll be capital appreciation and things on the tangible asset side, such as equities, et cetera. But I'm not really so sure you're going to see a tremendous recovery in the economy. We're still in this rising trend of unemployment, but people have to understand what that is also. We're looking at the transition here from government to the private sector. So the private sector has been increasing employment better, but we're also looking at, for example, even federally. I mean, they have, you know, freezes on hiring new people, et cetera. So as they retire, they're trying to reduce the workforces. State and local governments who can't print money are being forced to lay off more and more people.
Let's talk about something you've written about, and that is the 13-year curse. Explain that for our listeners and how it applies to today.
For some reason, there tends to be the number 13 that, like, they don't put it, you know, like a 13th floor in a building or whatever. But historically, you go back and you look at most of these bull markets, they tend to make a high in the 13th year or a low. And in this particular case with the metals, I've been saying that if we can get a low here in gold rather than brand new highs, if we get a brand new high, it could be really very, very serious. Then you're looking at more of a 2-year correction. But if we can get a low here in gold, for example, this year, now you're looking at it's forming a more of a base, and then we can begin to rise again. And then we would be looking at a high going into 2017. But I know a lot of the gold bugs don't like that. They want to see it going up year after year after year. But historically, you just can't do that. We've had a good run since 1999, and there has to be certain pauses. Markets just have to do so. It's like you need sleep at night. You go to sleep, you get a little rest, you wake up, you're refreshed, and you take off again. And that's the way markets are. right now that, you know, people, there's so much cash out there that, you know, I think you're going to start seeing it shifting from the, more of the from the bond market into the stock market. And as the stocks begin to take off better, you're going to have much more capital begin to move away from the sovereign debt and into the private sector. And that's going to create the debt crisis that we're looking at around 2017.
So basically, as our debt levels keep increasing, which they're doing now, there's no, at least, will in either party in Washington to control spending. I mean, they can talk about it, but there's nothing seriously done about it. We still are going to have to issue new debt. And as long as people keep buying it, there's still a lot of cash on the sidelines. And as you mentioned earlier, we're still the best looking house in a bad neighborhood right now.
Japan is terrible. And Europe is basically a basket case. So when you're looking at, and the dollar happens to be the reserve currency. So there's not much that you can do with central banks, et cetera, and then banks that have to keep their reserves. It's got to be dollars. So we have to see that trend begin to change. And right now, as long as people still perceive that there are problems in Europe that they have not solved, you have a lot of capital coming over that's parking in dollars, which helps to keep the interest rates low besides the Fed. And as the U.S. stock market begins to take off, where a lot of the other stock markets are looking down, you're going to get more and more foreign capital coming in for that.
So if we're looking at the gold market, and I'm looking at a Bloomberg chart of gold going back to the year 2000, it seems, Martin, that we've had these big surges in gold, and then it'll sit there and consolidate. You know, I'm looking at, like, for example, between 2006 and 2007, we had a nice run-up in 2008, then a downtrend into the credit crisis, and it's almost been straight up since then. So it's not unusual, especially those interested in gold, and I know that people don't like to hear that, but it's actually healthy.
Yeah, I mean, you need the pause. What creates a crash is sometimes people just don't, they don't quite understand. What it, you're really looking at is every time the market collapses, they want to have an investigation, find out who shorted the market, et cetera, and they have never found anybody. The reason for this is that it takes a tremendous amount of courage to short a market like that when it's going up and making new highs all the time. What you're really looking at is the fact that you have gotten the bulk of the people who were ever going to buy have bought. Now they're all sitting there and they're counting their profits for the next 10 years. Some news comes out that scares them. What you then get are these flash-type crashes, because what happens is if you've got, for example, 75% of the people that had ever thought about buying are already in, once the market starts to come down a little bit, they have to get out. They get out so they don't lose their shirts, and then what happens is there are no bids, so you'll get something that will drop very sharply, very rapidly. And that's why a market, when it comes down, it goes down very, very fast. It goes up slow because it takes a, just human nature. It takes a long time to convince everybody to get in. Once they're all in, now it's very easy. You scare them. It's like a herd of zebra. And they all run at the same time. And when that happens, you get these types of flash crashes. So you have to have the pullback. Once you get the weaker longs out of there, then you are building a base, and then you start all over again. And you then begin to attract people again, and then you start taking off, and you run rapidly back up to the upside. This is just the way all market structures function. And that's why every stock market investigation from 07, and, you know, the Great Depression, 87, they have never uncovered anybody, this huge short position that everybody anticipates forced it down. That's not it.
Martin, in conclusion, then we're more likely to see higher stock prices. Things are going okay for the economy, not in a spectacular fashion, but at least they're improving. And it looks better here than, let's say, Japan or Europe. So this money is gradually gravitating out of low interest-paying instruments, and I think investors are going to be doing what banks are doing. If I could keep my money in cash, or I can invest it or lend it and earn a higher return, and I can earn a higher return. I never thought I'd see this for quite some time, but I can earn a higher return in buying something like Johnson & Johnson or a utility stock than I could leaving it in cash.
Absolutely, and my opinion, you're probably safer. But, you know, some of the banks are, you know, are still dodgy, and I think that particularly the ones that are involved in aggressively trading. But this is the way bull markets really, really begin. 1925 was the same thing, exactly the same thing. Interest rates become low enough that you begin to look at it and you say, well, I can earn more over here. And that's what begins it, the transition. And at this point in time, honestly, we have a sovereign debt crisis that is very, very serious. And do you really want to have all your money in government debt? And I think that institutional investors understand it, but perhaps, you know, the general public does not. The difference between sovereign debt and private debt is substantial. If you bought, you know, General Motors bonds or whatever, and General Motors goes bankrupt, they take all the assets of General Motors, they sell it, and you get something back. If a government goes bust and defaults, you get nothing back. It's unsecured. You can't go down to the National Gallery and start taking Picassos. So there is a substantial difference between public debt and private debt. Private debt is at least there are some tangible assets behind it. Whereas public debt, it's basically just the full faith and confidence in the government. That's it. You get nothing back. So I personally think that if you're going to be looking at your long-term stability for retirement, et cetera, at this stage in the game, shy away from all government debt, period. And you're better off looking at some of the better companies, preferred stock, paying good dividends. I mean, look in those areas.
Martin, you and I are thinking alike. As we close, I want to talk about something that you've offered on your website that I find fascinating because we both have a love of Roman history, and that's Roman coins. Tell me about that.
Well, we were getting so many because I've written and published charts on the collapse of Rome. And so I was getting a number of people asking, gee, you know, how can you get these things? So during the 3rd century is when Rome really collapsed. To put it in some sort of a plausible idea, money fell to 1/50th of what it was. Mm. And so the same human traits that existed then exist now. When banks are in trouble, et cetera, people hoard their cash. They don't spend it. And the same thing happened back then. So what has happened is that from the 3rd century, there are a number of what are called hoards, and people actually literally did bury their money in pots and things of this nature, and a lot of Roman coins have been uncovered. There was like a find, I think in 07, like 50,000 coins in one huge pot. So, I mean, there are Roman coins that you can get that are corroded, which aren't necessarily that expensive, like, you know, $5 or something. But coins that are fully readable, etc., you know, you can get for, you know, maybe $15 to, you know, $50 range from the 3rd century. So what we were offering there is a lot of people were asking, gee, can you actually put a set together? And there was a hoard that was discovered, and so we were able to get a progression of where the coins began in silver and then collapse the bronze so that people can actually put together a small little set of Roman coins showing the collapse of the Roman monetary system.
Yeah, I'm seeing that you've got Valerian, which was silver, Solania, and Postumus, silver, and then the rest, I guess, turned to bronze. Rather fascinating.
Right. So, I mean, you get like a nice little series there for about, you know, $600. And you got about 15 different emperors.
What's the difference between the $600 set and the $2,500 set?
Well, the Romans were very ingenious. And what they did was that they were trying to make the bronze look like it was silver. So they put in some silver and they used chemicals to bring the silver to the surface. So when the coins are first issued, they appear to be silver plated. And so that higher price one are the top grades where maybe a collector wants the silver still intact, etc., which wears off very quickly. So they're like the top grade. But that would be more for a collector that's really interested in that sort of thing. The rest of them, you find the silver might not be on it, but, you know, it's fully readable. You know, it's just a brown, you know, bronze coin. And they go up to, you know, Diocletian and Maximinus, who basically started the Tetrarch period. So he started with a major reform and then brings silver back. And then Constantine comes in, etc. So it's a good run.
That's a good, fascinating way to put together a collection. Martin, listen, as always, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Do you have any seminars coming up that you'd like to share with our listeners?
We're probably going to do Berlin in Europe in June, San Francisco probably in September, and looks like Bangkok probably in November.
And will you be posting these on your website?
Yes, that would be at armstrongeconomics.com.
All right. We've been speaking with Martin Armstrong. If you'd like to find out more about Martin's work or read his essays, you can do that at armstrongeconomics.com and also get information about Martin's upcoming seminars. Martin, as always, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.